The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly and I'm Tom Clark. Watered down banking reform, an unpopular NHS shake-up, a looming AV referendum, and now a controversial immigration speech. 1 year after the love-struck marriage in May, are the fault lines in this political merger called the Coalition coming under strain? As France enforces a ban on Islamic veils, is it democracy in action or the tyranny of the majority? And also this week, the sun is out, the daffodils are in bloom, but how happy are you? And what do you want the government to do about it? Joining me for all of this in the studio, we have The Guardian's political columnist Seamus Milne and Anne Perkins, as well as The Observer's Raphael Baer. A warm welcome to you all. Now, as we record, David Cameron is giving a major speech on immigration, and it's already been described by loyal Cabinet Minister Vince Cable as, quotes, very unwise. This comes in a week where we had a report into the future of the banks, which fell short of what Cable had called for. And we've also had Nick Clegg's close friend, Norman Lamb, threatening to resign over the NHS reforms. An increasingly bad-tempered debate is also marking the run-up to the AV referendum. Raph, we've come to multiculturalism in a moment, but is all this the normal knockabout stuff, or is there something more serious going on?
Well, the fact is we don't know, because we haven't had a sort of peacetime coalition in, you know, our memory. And up until now, there haven't been elections. This referendum campaign is quite unprecedented. So everyone foresaw when they made the coalition agreement that this would be a period where there would be a lot of turbulence and it would be very difficult to get through. People predicted that the coalition wouldn't survive. My own feeling is that it will, but it will have to be renegotiated ad hoc as they go through this, and particularly when there's a result in the referendum. Frankly, the big problem would be the Lib Dems deciding they can't go ahead with this coalition. Looking at their opinion poll ratings, they're not in a hurry to trigger an election, therefore they'll stick with it.
Anne, I mean, do you think, just on the Cable question, you've got senior cabinet minister saying the prime minister's being very unwise. Do you think the political culture can allow that to continue?
Well, Vince Cable in earlier times might have been described as a semi-detached member of the government, mightn't he? But I think he has a certain license, I'd say. He's already ridden through a lot. I think Raph's right that ultimately the coalition survives on the willingness of the Lib Dems to be part of it rather than on any particular item of policy. So I think this, you know, this will be another kind of bending of the parameters of coalition, and it'll come through.
Seamus, what do you think? Sustainable?
Well, Cable is damaged goods already, isn't he? And very much weakened after the Murdoch affair. I mean, as Anne says, he has got some licence, and the Lib Dems have some licence because the Tories are worried about the pressures on them. But of course, they have their own pressures. I mean, I do think that this latest spat over Cameron's immigration speech is really, you know, tightening the screws quite a lot. And I mean, the only thing, as Raphael says, that is going to keep them sticking to it is the, paradoxically, their very, very bad opinion poll results and the hammering they're going to get in the local elections, because if they were really to test it in a general election, they'd be facing potential wipeout. So at least for some of them, that's going to hold them in there, isn't it? But one question we've always been thinking about from the beginning of this coalition government is whether or not the Liberal Democrat Party itself might fracture, and I think that is quite a strong possibility.
I mean, do you think this is specifically pre-election stuff, where like both sides are going to give each other temporary license to just go off and badmouth the others a bit, and they'll all understand that they don't really mean it because it's, you know,
to
their base?
I think they will. They have anticipated that would happen, and certainly I have no doubt at all that this speech that David Cameron has made is a piece of cynical electioneering, because they've, you know, they wanted to blast the health reforms off the front pages. You just need to look at the coordination between what he said and the way it's splashed on the front page of the Daily Mail to see the political coordination that's gone
to try and start
a different narrative. What I think they've underestimated in sort of wargaming this idea of a short-term creative license to be a bit fractious, to then reconvene and have a nice Rose Garden press conference after the AV referendum, is the low-level attrition of trust that goes on when ministers and people in the government start to play the who's been briefing against me, where did that quote come from, how did that get out kind of game, sort of Cluedo of how are these stories coming out. And then once those personal relationships and networks have been a bit eroded, they can't go back to how they were before. And I think they haven't quite thought that through.
Also, the AV referendum result is going to put a lot of pressure, whichever way it goes, on the two sides. So
I think we need to consider how weak the Conservatives are in this partnership as well. I mean, yeah, the Lib Dems are weak, but I think the Tories are really weak too. I think they're in real trouble on the NHS reforms. I think they're very anxious about the economy. You know, they're taking such a huge gamble, and the omens are not particularly good at the moment. I think they're struggling with the nature of government. They're struggling with being in power, and I think they are really on a knife edge. I think, in a way, they actually need each other as the Tories need the Lib Dems as much as the Lib Dems need the Tories to save each other from electoral oblivion.
Although it's winding up the Tory right more and more as every day passes, isn't it? And they who feel excluded and their birthrights being denied them.
The big mystery in that is what the new intake are going to do, because there are a lot of young Tories. Ideologically, they're to the right of Cameron in many respects, although they're also socially liberal, being from Cameron's generation and younger. And they will either decide that taking a principled stand and becoming a new awkward squad will advance their position, or they will basically want ministerial jobs and stick with Cameron. And no one seems to know in the Parliamentary Conservative Party where those new... which way they're going to jump.
But isn't the point that they won't have those ministerial jobs because of the coalition, and that's one of the things that's winding them up? Yeah.
But also, I just my sense, obviously I'm not in Westminster on a day-to-day basis anymore, but it doesn't feel like the old days when there was a really powerful right that could hold a Tory government to ransom. You feel that the new people are... do you kind of think about politics in a different way? Maybe because they are new and they're not used to the kind of political operation in Westminster. It just doesn't have that kind of entrenched feel yet that it did have, say, in the worst of the major years.
Isn't there a really good point that Anne was making there about the fact that the Tories are already weak, have already given lots of ground to the Liberal Democrats? Cameron said that his priorities could be summed up in three letters, NHS, and now his, and it was his after he... nodded it through, NHS plan is scuppered. Aren't the Liberal Democrats sort of now finding themselves for the first time in a position of real power, but unsure how to put that across to anyone?
Well, there's two elements of that. One, everything the Liberal Democrats do or try to use, the way they try to exert their influence on the coalition in the sort of public perception will be dwarfed by the fact that they've gone along with the big macroeconomic fiscal strategy. So they've signed up to the cuts, and they can try and sell everything else they're doing in various different ways, but they are associated with George Osborne's big economic gamble. So they're sort of sink or swim on that one. On the Conservative side, I think it is a massive problem for them, but not partly because they're losing their position on the NHS, which is toxic for their brand in the country, but also because there is this now narrative in the Conservative Party that Cameron is a serial loser. He should have won an election in the sort of most auspicious circumstances ever against Gordon Brown, economic recession. He got outmaneuvered in the negotiations over the coalition, conceding more than he needed to.
In terms of jobs.
And just in terms of jobs and in terms of granting a referendum, all sorts of other things that he did. This is the perspective from the right wing of the Conservative Party. If he then loses the AV referendum, the Conservative right will increasingly start to ask, who is this loser who we've actually signed up to? The whole point of having him in the first place was that he was a winner.
Seamus, in the light of that, we've got this referendum now in 20-something days. From your anti-coalition perspective, which way would you want it to go, just in terms of low politics? It's going to dish the Conservatives if it gets through, and it's going to dish the Liberal Democrats if it
Well, goes from the anti-coalition
way.
Perspective, it's a win-win, isn't it, really? I mean, I think... If the referendum's lost, the damage probably will be greater because for the Lib Dems, it's so much of a game changer, or they think it is. Whether it actually would be, given the level of support they've now got overall, is another question. But anyway, they've always seen it, and most people would regard it as something that would favour them. So if it's lost, and you know the single biggest thing that they were hoping to get out of the coalition will be down the drain. So I think all the things we've been talking about will be very strongly exacerbated. On the other hand, if it's won, all the things that Raphael said are very true, that the Tory right will be more and more enraged that Cameron is selling more and more bits of their birthright as they see it. So
you're going to be enjoying May this this year more than last year, either way.
It's going to be a great May.
I truly don't understand this, the whole AV thing. I don't understand why Clegg accepted it, because AV is a miserable little compromise. It's not a proportional system. There's nothing really in it for the Lib Dems. It's been hyped up to be this kind of great game changer, but it is only significant because of the hype. It's not actually going to change anything on the ground at all.
I think all the sort of modelling shows that it would deliver them more seats in almost all conceivable outcomes. I mean, it only wouldn't if their support falls so low that they're in.
And it might just have made a difference in this last election,
Well, they would have certainly got more seats.
Yeah.
Let's leave that there. There's going to be lots more about AV, of course, in the weeks ahead, and there's going to be a full guide to the elections in May, including a special podcast with Michael White at guardian.co.uk/politics. Now, as we've been hearing, David Cameron's been caught in controversy this morning on multiculturalism and immigration once again. But across the channel in France, President Sarkozy has taken an altogether more full-throated approach. This week has seen the enforcement of the ban on the Islamic veil with seemingly little in the way of dissent. Joining us on the line from Paris is The Guardian's own Angélique Chrysaphis. Angélique, you've witnessed the first week of the ban. What's happened so far, and is anyone complaining?
Well, it's interesting here because, of course, we have the separation of church and state in the great secular French Republic. So there hasn't been a vast amount of dissent, which I think is quite hard for English readers of The Guardian to understand. The law came into power on Monday. We've seen about 5 women stopped in the street by police, some in suburban shopping centres, mostly in the outskirts of Paris, but also in Orléans. Some of them have been fined. Some of them have been taken to the police station to remove their veil and show their faces. And they've been fined when they've been refused to totally remove their veil in public. This basically reflects the fact that there's very few women in France who actually wear this face covering, far fewer than the UK, probably only a few hundred. That's why we've only seen a few cases.
I think I read that when it went through the lower house of the French Parliament with 500-odd MPs, you had 340-something votes in favour and only one against. I mean, aren't there people who want to vote against just on the basis if there's only a few hundred or thousand people who wear this thing? It's a waste of parliamentary time.
Well, actually, hang on, let's go back to that because that's an interesting point. Now, let's just look at where this law came from. It goes back to June 2009. It was actually proposed by a communist MP on the outskirts of Lyon. And he'd seen a few people in wearing niqab, what he called walking prisons, when he spoke to me. But he said that he'd been going on about this for years and years and years. And this idea of banning the niqab, or the burqa, as we call it in France, has been shelved repeatedly. You know, he's been making proposals and it's just been dumped in a drawer and never looked back on. Now, Sarkozy picked this up because there was a general sort of Islamophobic, sort of xenophobic thrust of French politics at the moment, and he picked up on it. His party pushed it through. But when you look at the vote in the lower house, yes, there was only one dissenting voice, but why was that? It was because the Socialists, the Greens, and the other opposition group, the communists as well, walked out during the vote and refused to vote. That doesn't mean they were against the ban, actually. They were pro the ban, they were against the niqab, but they decided that constitutionally they didn't like the law. So even they, by walking out, weren't actually opposing this idea of punishing women for wearing it. It's a strange atmosphere at the moment here where the word secular can actually be replaced with the word truly French. It's about fear of the other and fear of the foreigner.
And you're nodding there. I mean, it's striking, isn't it, that in France this has been described as something that is about protecting women, and there's this attached proposal to fine men who make women wear this thing more. But it's a fairly warped form of feminism, isn't it?
What's a warped form of feminism?
Feminism that would ban the full face veil.
Well, I think it's much, much more complicated than that. I think it's also particularly French, isn't it, Angélique? I mean, this is an argument that's been kind of current. There was a big row sort of 5-6 years ago about the burqa in schools, wasn't there?
And hijab.
That was the hijab,
yes,
In
2004, basically any religious symbol was banned in schools. So that meant across any.
Which
kind
is all
of
part
symbol.
Of the separation of church and state. And
absolutely, and also a headscarf. But of course, this idea of the niqab, and if you've got a few hundred people at most, I mean, there might only be 50 people wearing this in France who are kind of doing shopping in shopping centres. And no one has really mentioned at this stage any kind of Islamist threat or terrorism or anything. It's really come down to this idea, as in fact, the head of Sarko's party said to me himself, I want to see someone's face if I see them in the street.
And I was wondering whether the fact that ID cards you have to be uncovered for as well, and whether that kind of plays into the whole kind of uniqueness of the situation in France.
Well, yes, actually, the government would argue completely, because if you look at the technicality of the law, of course, they couldn't just use the wording no niqabs. So they used the wording you cannot have your face covered in public, which means they had to have exemptions for motorcycle helmets because you would have been breaking the law. Also, if you're wearing a fencing mask or, you know, dressed as Mickey Mouse at Euro Disney. So they basically said you can't cover your face in public because we need to see what you look like and who you are. So that's totally the argument they used.
Wonder about children on the way to Halloween parties dressed up as ghosts, Seamus. I mean, it's...
Well, no, because they've actually made an exemption for any kind of street carnival, and I guess that would be included in that.
But it's a striking contrast with Britain, isn't it, Seamus? I mean, Vince Cable's laying into Cameron this morning for talking about restraining immigration. He's sort of on the same territory, but no one apart from the real fringe conservative right would talk about legislating against what some women have decided to wear.
Well, of course, you know, there are newspapers like the Daily Express in Britain which are campaigning for what they call a burqa ban. And of course, the word burqa is very freighted because it's something that's only worn in Pakistan and Afghanistan and is tied up very much with the war on terror and the Afghanistan occupation, which, of course, France is taking part of. But I think, you know, you've got to call a spade a spade. This is a racial or ethnic proxy when it comes down to, or a religious proxy. I mean, in France, there's a very specific historical issue, which is this, the role of secularism in the state and the importance of it to the concept of the French Republic. And that is the proxy through which this, what I would regard as effectively a racist campaign, is carried out. Now, I mean, the French left have real problems about it because their whole history is bound up with the battle against the power of the Catholic Church in France, in which secularism was a hugely important weapon. When it's instead of being targeted against some forces that are very powerful, is then targeted against vulnerable communities, albeit
2,000 people.
Well, I mean, of course, the Muslim community in France is 5 million, the biggest Muslim community in Western Europe, or in Europe. And so that's at the heart of this whole issue. But it's dressed up in this secular liberalism, whereas, of course, in real political terms, it's about the rise of the return of the National Front, the far-right racist party in France, which, you know, is feeding off the fear of the other that Angelique was talking about, and the sort of fear of Islam and the hostility to the ethnic minority population, and is doing very well.
And Raf, we spoke on the programme last week, I think it was, we did a kind of Europe special and was struck by how many of these like far-right parties there are that have different agendas, but the thing that's tying them together at the moment is not liking Muslims very much.
Well, I mean, I we're all going to end up violently agreeing on this, and I agree with Seamus entirely. The idea that you could somehow, through some discourse about laïcité, separate out this legislative measure from a broader cultural discussion that's going on in Europe, including in this country, but happily more on the fringes, that Islam is somehow intellectually or fundamentally culturally incompatible with a European/Western way of doing things, which is essentially sort of a racist narrative. I mean, obviously, these things are bound up together. What surprises me, and I find shocking as a Francophile, is that there appears to be no major mainstream political movement, parliamentary movement in France that can articulate quite basically the idea that the state should not be ordering people what they can and can't wear.
I just think I just think it's a really, really, really difficult problem. And I don't think it's, you seem to find it easier than I do. I find it very hard to cope with the difficulty of, I know some women would wear the niqab from choice, but others wouldn't. How do you know, you know, which is which? How do you sort out culture and race from other kinds of independence? How can you kind of police some aspects, things like forced marriage or, you know, other things that are culturally and racially appropriate for some people and not for others?
But if it's all very difficult, isn't the one thing you don't want a sort of heavy-handed law?
Yeah.
And it's extraordinary that no one's arguing against it, isn't it, Anne?
Well, I just really struggle with this. Because I think to some extent the law does protect women who don't want to be made to wear the niqab.
Angelique, final word on this to you.
Yeah, I would just say that the French police would actually beg to differ, because they've got this horrendous task, which they said they can't do and they don't really have much intention of doing. Not only do they have to tell women in the street to stop wearing their niqabs, which is hard enough because they've got better things to do, they say, but they've also now got to try and work out whether these women have been forced to do it by their husbands or fathers and then fine these men €30,000. And the police themselves have said it's almost impossible. Actually, it is impossible to do, and they're not going to bother doing it.
Well, another cross-channel issue this week happens to be happiness. Cameron has said he wants all to smile a bit more. He's been talking about general well-being instead of general gross national product for some time now. And this week, political happiness broke out of the laboratory as Professor Richard Layard launched his Action for Happiness group. He says we've got richer, but we haven't got much happier, and that well-being needs to be measured alongside economic growth. Now, Angelique, Cameron is actually following Sarkozy on this one again, isn't he? How far have the French taken this concept?
Well, they've taken it quite far. If you think that France is famous for being really grumpy and the French people are always complaining, and that sounds like a stereotype, but it's actually very important to politicians, because most French people in polls are always saying they're not happy with their lot. So where we are in France on this is we've actually got to a methodology of how to measure happiness. We've gone further than the UK, and who will be following Paris on this. So the French National Office of Statistics has actually drawn up a sort of plan of how to measure this. And they've asked some quite interesting questions to people to find out things like, you know, do you own at least two pairs of shoes? And how difficult is your house to heat? And is it too small to have friends around? So those are kind of clear material issues. But they've also got things to do with socialising. You know, do you not just see friends for a night out, but do you casually bump into people you know in the street? Are you in touch with your family? And this idea of, do you have a stake in society? For example, do you vote? So they've also decided that measuring happiness is incredibly difficult. One of the statisticians said to me, you can't measure happiness because everyone's got a very different idea of it. So if you say to someone, are you happy, they can't express it in the same way as the next person. So what they've done is looked at how dissatisfied people are. Do they think they're missing out on happiness? They've approached it that way.
So they've made it miserabilist for the French taste.
They've made it miserabilist because it is France, but they've found that they are able to track who is likely to be the least happy, and it makes complete sense. It's not just material issues, it's to do with housing, society and so on. And they found that single-parent families are likely to be the least happy of all.
And, I mean, it sounds like it's very hard to do it properly, but is it worth having a go, do you think?
Oh yeah, definitely worth having a go, but I think the miserabilist approach is probably the right one, because pursuing happiness, we know, is a chimera, but avoiding unhappiness is a much more kind of sort of tangible way to go.
And what do you think, Seamus?
Well, it's obvious when the Tory Liberal Democrat government is having trouble with GDP, in fact, you know, which is flatlining and there's no growth, obviously it's not surprising they might want to look around for some other measurement. But I think the basic idea is right, you know, that GDP doesn't measure contentment or well-being. I think there's a problem with the word happiness because it sounds a bit silly to a lot of people. But the idea that you want to measure and you want to encourage other things in society which can't be measured by economic statistics is a good one. And, I mean, you know, people's social relationships, their family relationships, their friendships, you know, the old work-life balance syndrome. I mean, all these things are about contentment in society. And, you know, the insecurity and unhappiness that has grown and has been measured in this society, for example, among children and teenagers in particular, in a very shocking way, is something that we need to attend to, including government needs to attend to, in a much more focused way. And so I think the spirit behind it is good, even if some of the aspects of it are dodgy.
Yeah, I'd agree with Seamus to the extent that a lot of those measures that Angelique described are actually seem to be focusing in on what you'd call quality of life, and that happiness, I mean, interestingly, in some of the empirical studies they've done in terms of finding out how happy people are, the way they do that is by phoning them up and asking them, how happy are you? It's that simple. You know when you're happy, and likewise, you know when you're not. I'm a bit wary of sort of disaggregating happiness from material well-being. There's this famous statistic that's often quoted that GDP and happiness only sort of track one another up to a point, and then after a while, you know, general GDP increases. Yeah, people get a bit rich and then they stop getting any happier. But this is a slightly false comparison, because GDP can carry on growing and people can get richer and richer, but we don't know what the upper ceiling of happiness is. So it's a bit like saying, well, you know, you can work out, you can get bigger and stronger, or you can eat lots and get fatter and fatter, but you might not get any cleverer.
So, but there's this oddity here, isn't there? Because where it might be true that if you double someone's income and come back and look at them in a year's time, they might not be any happier, or they'll have found something else to worry about. On a day-to-day basis, and when it comes to an incremental change, people do want more money and do want an economy that's going to give them a better prospect of a job.
Yeah, but I mean, the the Beatles were right. You know, money can't buy you love, but it can buy you a lot of other things, and probably which will then give you the leisure to go and maybe find love. So the material well-being is fantastic.
Of course, there's another aspect which is difficult for the government, which is that more and more measurements show that inequality increases social tension, social unhappiness, and greater equality in society increases well-being. And that's very difficult for a government that's doing the kind of things that this one is.
But there is also I'm not sure whether I agree with Raf, because I thought there was evidence that said that if you present people with two courses of action, and course A will make you happier and course B will earn you more money, most people take course B. So there is some kind of, you know, there's some kind of, you know, desire to get rich, which kind of outweighs of, I suppose, a confidence in a deliberate source of action that makes you happy.
Maybe they don't believe in course A.
And the other interesting problem in this respect is the phenomenon they call hedonic adaptation, which is that people tend to sort of ping back to however happy they were anyway. And so there's been a study, I understand, which compared lottery winners with people who'd had kind of horrible accidents a year on, and actually the sort of net outcome in terms of who was happier was completely unchanged. If you're a miserable person and you win a lottery, you're happy for a bit and then you ping back to being pretty miserable, and if you're a generally optimistic person and you lose your legs, in a year's time you're still quite optimistic, quite chipper.
so nothing changes. Angelique, I mean, in France, would you say this is seen as a way of changing the subject from more difficult discussions about you know, why unemployment's high or whatever it is, or do you think it's got quite wide buy-in, like it seems to around this table?
No, I think that people are hugely sceptical. Of course, that's the way that they are over here, we know from the surveys. But no, people are very sceptical because their problem here is that salaries are incredibly low, and people's, what we call purchasing power over here, is incredibly low as well. So we've just seen a new wave of strikes starting today, and industrial action in supermarkets and lots of big companies. People feel that Sarkozy hasn't solved those problems at all, and that jumping ahead to some idea of happiness, he's just trying to basically, you know, shut people up and they won't buy it. So there's a lot of scepticism on that.
It's actually the happiness thing. In fact, it hasn't only just been discovered. It's kind of backwash from the era of prosperity, and people were kind of looking around for things that government could do, because now we were all rich and we're going to be rich in perpetuity. Only it didn't work out like that.
No. Well, it's my unhappy duty to tell you that that's all we've got time for this week. So my thanks to Angelique, to Seamus, to Anne, and to Raphael for being with us this morning. And the producer was Phil Maynard. Thanks very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.